This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk to the researcher behind a new report on budgetary challenges facing Wisconsin townships. Now, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is working on its first ever standards for regulating the harmful chemicals known as PFAS. The new rules will set limits for how much of the chemicals can be present in the state's drinking water and surface waters. That's going to require sampling and testing of water systems, remediation if the standards aren't met. Environmental groups see it as a positive for public health and the environment, while businesses and local governments have raised concerns about how much it would cost to meet these standards. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about these new standards? Do you want tighter regulation on these chemicals? The EPA now is out with advisory guidelines as well. Join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Danielle Kading is a reporter at WPR's Superior Bureau. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
These standards have been in the works for a while. How did we get here?
Yeah, so back in 2019, Governor Tony Evers directed the agency, or the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, to develop standards to address PFAS contamination across the state. And then the Natural Resources Board signed off on developing those standards in January the following year. And then it's been about three years now since we started talking about this, since when they were finally approving standards through the Natural Resources Board, which are now set to take effect as soon as they go through the final steps in the process.
This gets complicated because we're talking about different kinds of water, whether it's surface or drinking water. There are actually different chemicals in this PFAS category. Big picture, Danny, when this thing kicks in, what changes?
Well, when this kicks in, this means that there will be a requirement for public water supplies to test for PFAS. And right now, it's about just really a fraction of the 11,000 public water supplies in Wisconsin have tested for PFAS. Some of them have urged the DNR to wait for federal standards for drinking water rather than proposing statewide limits on PFAS. And so now that this is happening, there will be a phase-in, a gradual phase-in of which communities or which systems will be required to test and how often and how that works.
Now, this had to be signed off on by a group of state lawmakers led by Republicans. They did say they'll do this. They could, as I understand it, maybe still suspend the standards if they don't feel they're being lawfully implemented. Can you just talk about the role that the state legislature is playing here?
Yeah, so basically once the Natural Resources Board moved these standards forward, it could go to the Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules in the legislature. And that's basically led and controlled by Republican lawmakers. And so in the past, we've seen Republican lawmakers push back on attempts to regulate these chemicals. There were no objections raised this go around. So they're letting those take effect. And now it moves to the secretary for him to sign. That would be DNR Secretary Preston Cole. And then the rules will be submitted to Wisconsin's Administrative Register, and then they'll take effect about a month after publication.
And then when they take effect, does that mean day one cities have to get out there and start testing, or how does it phase in a way that we're going to see it have an effect?
No. What we've heard before from the Wisconsin DNR as of late May is that potentially, as soon as November, we could see the largest public water systems begin testing for PFAS. And some of them have already begun testing or done the sampling already, like Madison, Milwaukee, Eau Claire, Wausau. Those communities that have 50,000 or more people would be required to test. And then it would go in through phases for each other community based on their population size.
Danny, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, with us for a look at new state standards on PFAS chemicals in water. Now, just after these state standards got the go-ahead, the Environmental Protection Agency announced new advisory guidelines at the federal level for PFAS pollution. David Strifling is the director of the Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you again.
Okay, with these EPA advisories, we're talking parts per trillion for some of these PFAS chemicals, much narrower than what the state is working on. Can you give us a sense of the difference in scale that we're talking about here?
Well, it's orders of magnitude. And what caused all this is that EPA's previous guideline had been 70 parts per trillion for a couple of the PFAS compounds that we're focused on here. And that's where the NRB landed in terms of approving the DNR's rules, because it felt that the state standards should match the federal standards. Well, now the EPA has sort of, I don't want to say pulled the rug out, but dramatically changed the game board by saying, well, instead of 70 parts per trillion for those compounds, we're going to lower it to 0.004 parts per trillion for PFOA and 0.02 for PFOS. So again, that's orders of magnitude lower than where it was before. And it's also significantly lower than the detection limit, which I understand to be about 4 parts per trillion. So we're talking about really undetectable levels of compounds here. And the question for DNR is, what do we do now that our standard, our brand new standard, is orders of magnitude higher than what the EPA is now telling us is safe?
What do we know about why the EPA narrowed that by orders of magnitude, as you said?
Well, they just say that they focused on the science. You know, we had a conversation here at Marquette last week, and we had Secretary Cole here with the EPA Region 5 Administrator, Deborah Shore. And I asked Regional Administrator Shore that question, you know, what's taking so long? Why the big change? And she said, we're just focused on the science. And this is what the science is telling us. It takes time for us to do this. We're sorry we're not moving faster, but we're going to take the time to do it right. And, you know, I'm not a scientist. I don't pretend to understand all the explanation behind it, but that's what they're focused on.
And can you remind us why we're concerned about PFAS in our water? What are the health concerns that are leading these regulations?
Well, the first thing is that they're ubiquitous. It's very likely that if you and I were tested along with all of the listeners, these compounds would show up in our bloodstream. And pretty much that's true of every human being on the planet. And we know that they have significant health effects. They're carcinogens. They have significantly negative impacts on humans. And so they're in the environment, they're in our blood, and they cause lots of negative impacts on human health. And so I think everybody agrees on the need to do something about this. The disputes just come in at the margins, where we should set the limits, when they should kick in, who should be in charge, whether it's the state government or the federal government. That's what the dispute is about here.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Eric is with us in Lincoln County. Eric, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. Just a couple points. The NRB setting that number at 70 parts per trillion, everybody knew that number was way, way high. Anybody with any kind of common sense knew that that number was going to come in much lower from the EPA. And currently we have an NRB member who's more than a year expired from his term, yet he's still sitting on the board making these decisions. And then the other quick point is the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce suing to keep the DNR from being able to enforce the Wisconsin Spills Act. These two activities are extremely heinous when it comes to protecting our water, and I'm hoping some of these issues get straightened out and we start to accept what the real level of safe PFAS consumption is.
Eric, thanks a lot for that call. Dave, let's start with the second point, because people may see headlines about the DNR enforcing some kind of PFAS regulations, and that's under, as Eric referenced, the Spills Act, not these new regulations. What is going on there?
Yeah, so there we're talking about contamination primarily in groundwater, not in drinking water, although, of course, groundwater can become drinking water. And the question is, can DNR enforce what's called, as you said, the spills law against a business who's, you know, conducting a cleanup? And the specific issue in that lawsuit was whether midstream, in the middle of the cleanup, DNR could add a requirement for the business owner to clean up PFAS compounds. And that's what that lawsuit was all about. The Waukesha County Circuit Court judge said that DNR couldn't do that without having a standard in place, without having a list of hazardous substances that it would force a business owner to clean up. The way that stands right now is that the judge has stayed the effect of that ruling so that DNR can appeal it. So we're going to have to watch that one as that proceeds its way up through the chain of courts. It'll be at the Court of Appeals next. But I agree with the caller that that has some major implications for DNR's authority to regulate PFAS. No question about it, along with other substances as well.
And Eric also mentioned, and we've got an email from Matt in Madison along the same lines, mentioning Fred Preen, who is on the Natural Resources Board. His successor was appointed, never confirmed by the Senate, the state Senate. So he's still there, I think about a year into that now, and helping to set these policies. Is that a concern people are raising at this point?
Well, it's certainly a concern on both sides of the aisle. I don't have any, legal opinion on who's right and who's wrong, but that is a major controversy, yes.
Thanks for the call, Eric. We're talking to Marquette Law School adjunct professor Dave Strifling about new PFAS standards planned for Wisconsin, plus an advisory guideline from the Environmental Protection Agency. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have PFAS contamination in your community? How is it affecting you? Are you glad to see the state moving toward new regulations of these chemicals? Where do you think the level should be set? The EPA's very tight advisory guidelines are what we have in Wisconsin. Call in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Dave Strifling, director of the Marquette Law School's Water, Law, and Policy Initiative. He's with us today for a look at PFAS regulations on Wisconsin water. The DNR is working on new guidelines, and there's recommended guidelines out now from the EPA, much more stringent. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on these new standards at the state level, these new recommendations from the EPA? Is this an issue in your community? Are you drinking water out of bottles because you can't drink the water out of your tap? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So, I don't know, it was probably about 10 years ago, we had the whole issue with the BPAs and the baby formula bottles, and the manufacturers claimed, well, people demanded clear bottles, so the only way they could give us clear bottles was they had to put BPA in it. But that's obviously proven false because we have clear baby bottles still without BPA in it. Now we're being told that, oh, you've got to have PFAS or PFAS in the fire suppression foam in order to make it work better. Well, what is better? How much better? 1%, a tenth of a percent? Out of Truax, they probably dumped, in all the other airports that use this stuff, they probably dumped 1,000 times as much of this foam retardant to practice with it than they've ever used in practicality to fight an airplane fire. I can't even think of a report of an airplane fire out of Truax in the last 5 years, but it just seems like we're being duped into having to accept these chemicals, which now you've got lakes, Monona, Mendota, Wabisi, you can only eat one or two fish a month out of those things. And I wish the DNR, the state, would tighten up before these things get into our systems, before they get into the market.
Gotcha, Mike. I want to bring Dave Strifling in on this. Mike saying, can we stop using this stuff in the first place? He mentioned a common use of flame retardant, including at airports, but it's also lining nonstick pans, a lot of other uses. Are we working to get this stuff out of the product chain in the first place?
Yeah, it's a big issue. And we saw this with asbestos and a lot of other products along the way that in some cases, there just aren't any good substitutes, at least if the manufacturers are correct. And often what we see in environmental law is something called technology forcing. We want to force manufacturers to develop substitutes for these products by setting the limits lower and depend on our ingenuity, our technology, our R&D to come up with new solutions that aren't as toxic. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but that's the idea here.
Mike, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dennis is with us now in Green Bay. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I lived in Marinette for a number of years, over 20 years, and during that time, all this PFAS was being hidden by the legislature or a legislator up there, and he worked with the companies accepted campaign contributions, so PFAS kind of ran rampant up there. And now people are being that were exposed, and my children went to school there. I have two children that have thyroid problems. One had a appendiceal cancer, and they all went through school in the Marinette area. And I'm wondering, you know, is there anything going to be happening in terms of class action or something against these companies that dumped all these PFAS into the water? The high school in Marinette was right next to where they were doing testing with PFAS for fire suppression foam.
Dennis, thanks for the call. Sorry to hear about all that affecting your kids. Dave, are people connecting the dots, PFAS, to those sort of health conditions? And Dennis wonders, maybe class action lawsuits on the way?
Yeah, really, really sorry to hear about your family, Dennis. So there's a couple of different issues here. One is the kind of toxic tort suits for injuries and cancers and deaths that are coming from this. And the other is environmental cleanup suits to force the companies to clean up polluted water. And I foresee both of those expanding going forward in the future as more and more becomes known about the science. Now, the causation is really the hard part when you talk about toxic tort suits. How do you prove that what happened came from PFAS? And so that'll be the issue as opposed to some other cause. But on both of those fronts, you know, and at our event last week, DNR Secretary Cole and EPA Regional Administrator Shore both said, we will go after those companies. If we can tell who caused the problem, we're going to make them clean it up. And I think the same will be true on the toxic tort side. You're going to see more of that as the future comes.
Dennis, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Dave Strifling, director of the Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative, about regulations on these PFAS chemicals. PFAS, everybody else is saying. I never know which one to settle on. We heard, by the way, early on the morning show today from Deborah Shore with the EPA talking about this very issue. You can check that out in the archives. Dave, turning back to the EPA advisory guidelines, a keyword advisory. They're not binding on anybody, at least not yet. Is there a thought that they might be locked in and become an official federal regulation at some point in the future?
Well, it's a really interesting question because these advisory limits, they mean almost nothing and they mean everything all at the same time. As you said, they are advisory. They're non-binding. You can't enforce anything based on where these standards sit right now. But they certainly do form the basis for what states are doing, as we've seen in Wisconsin with the NRB approving standards for drinking water at a level that matched the then existing federal advisory limit. And I think you're also going to see that number become the basis for the enforceable maximum contaminant levels under the Safe Drinking Water Act that EPA is in the process of putting in place right now. Now, that's a process that can take some time. But I think this is a very significant number overall, because it has the scientific backing to form the basis for what both the states and the federal government are likely to do. And to answer your other question, Rob, about when are federal standards coming, I think you're likely to see something in the next year or two. Now, that won't be immediately enforceable. There is a period of time that public water systems have to comply with EPA limits, but it's coming sooner rather than later, at least if we believe what the EPA is telling us.
Even with the DNR guidelines, which again are way less stringent than this advice from the EPA, what is it going to take for local communities, for local water systems to comply with it? Is it going to be a challenge?
It will be, especially for the smaller systems. If you're a small system already struggling with budget, I've been reading about how the prices of everything is going up from groceries to gasoline. Well, local governments are hit with that too. And if you are one of those smaller systems and you come back with a large number for PFAS in your system, I think the DNR's advice is to drill a new well. Well, that's expensive, for one thing, and there's no guarantee that it's not pulling from the same source and won't be similarly contaminated for another. So, you know, again, it's a problem that everyone agrees something needs to be done, but when the rubber meets the road, it's not that easy to find a solution. You know, the bigger systems might be able to treat for it, install new treatment processes, but that's also an expensive proposition and one that might be out of reach for smaller systems. So in coming up with the rule, DNR did prepare cost estimates of, you know, how many systems it thought were likely to be affected and what the resulting cost might be. But we really have no idea how extensive the number is going to turn out in the end.
Now, this problem has been a long time in the making, and these chemicals don't really break down, not quickly, certainly by a human time span. Are we going to be dealing with stuff for, what, decades to come?
You know, it's like a lot of environmental problems, lead laterals, chlorides. This stuff, even if we turn off the faucet right now, the bathtub is still full. Carbon dioxide is another example of that. So, yeah, I think this is a problem that's going to be with us for a long time. We're finding out a lot more about these emerging contaminants, PFAS included, as we go. And we just have to do the best we can. But this is not something that is going to go away overnight.
And very briefly, what are you watching for next?
Well, I think the next big domino to fall will be enforceable standards, maximum contaminant levels under the Safe Drinking Water Act issued by the federal government. When that comes, all the states will have to fall into line.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's David Strifling, director of the Marquette Law School's Water Law and Policy Initiative. He was with us today looking at the impact of new PFAS standards set to go into place here in the state, regulating the so-called forever chemicals, plus new EPA guidelines. Earlier, we heard from WPR reporter Danielle Kading. You can follow her reporting on this issue at WPR.org. The congressional panel investigating the January 6th assault on the nation's capital is holding another hearing tomorrow. Live NPR coverage starts at noon here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Georgia's Secretary of State and other top election officials are expected to testify. President Biden won Georgia in the 2020 election. Former President Trump and his allies put pressure on those officials to try to undermine and overturn the results of the election. Join us for NPR special coverage of the January 6th hearings tomorrow at noon here on WPR. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we learned about a study on gun violence in Green Bay over the last few years and what it could mean for violence prevention in the future. Now, a new report from the nonpartisan nonprofit Wisconsin Policy Forum highlights budgetary challenges faced by many townships in the state. Cities and villages have similar shortfalls in state shared revenue, but towns have fewer properties to draw tax revenue from to fund services that often cover a bigger geographical area. That's forced some town governments to get creative with their financing, but it might not be sustainable. Jason Stein is the research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, I think a lot of times we might use town and village and city interchangeably. Town means something in the law. Remind us, Jason, what a town is before we get into the budget discussion.
Sure. So when we talk about towns as an actual government, not just like a geographical feature, Wisconsin has towns, cities, and villages. You have to live in one or the other. You can't live in both at the same time. And towns are not incorporated in Wisconsin, which means they don't deliver as many services as cities and villages do. If you look nationally, there's only 20 states with town governments and only 9 states that are like Wisconsin where you have to live in a town, city, or village. Some other states like Illinois, you can actually live in a town and a city at the same time because they organize things differently.
And a lot of towns in and of themselves might be pretty small, but collectively over a million of us in Wisconsin live in towns, right?
Right. So there's and that's because there's like 1,248 towns in Wisconsin. So there's a very large number. Even though there's only a small number of people that live in each one, together it's 1.6 million people. So it's like almost 28% of the state's population.
You checked out the budget situation facing towns around the state. What were some of the main things you found?
I mean, the one thing that really jumps out at you, if you look over the last generation, is how state aid has declined as a share of their budgets. And this is not unlike what we've seen happen for much larger cities and villages. In 1990, property taxes made up about 37% of revenues for towns in the state, and state aid was about 45%. By the time we get to 2020, property taxes made up 48% of town revenues, or almost half, and state aid had dropped to 30%, or less than one-third.
So they're getting more reliant on property taxes. There are downsides to that, I imagine?
Right. I mean, I think in particular for towns, I mean, one is that, you know, many state residents, you know, worry about the cost of their property taxes. It's a very salient tax that really jumps out at them when you pay it one time a year, unlike, say, sales taxes. And then, you know, there are pretty tight state limits on local property taxes. Essentially, to raise property taxes for your operating budget, most local governments, you know, there are some exceptions, but generally you need to have new development for that to happen under state law. And towns simply don't get as much new development as other cities and villages in the state. And even in the case of the larger communities, you know, if you look statewide, it's still less than the rate of inflation typically.
You mentioned that towns tend to provide fewer services than cities and villages. What are they on the hook for in their town budgets?
I mean, the traditional big thing that towns provide is road maintenance and construction. And, you know, if you look back to 1990, that's almost half of their budgets go to that one thing. It was 48%. By 2020, though, that share had dropped some. And I think that may reflect to some degree the financial challenges of towns because and we can talk about it, they've had increasing debt payments. Other things that they do trash pickup. They do fire and EMS services, which is another area where they've had challenges. So those are the kind, you know, law enforcement, things like that, more rare to see towns provide that. You see that more from counties or other municipalities.
To what extent are towns around the state getting stretched thin here?
Well, so, I mean, I think a good example would be the fire and EMS services. So traditionally, what towns have done is they've relied on a volunteer or a paid on-call staffing model. So, you know, where they're not paying their fire and EMS workers at all, or they're only paying them for the actual hours that they work responding to calls. You know, that's a low-cost method. In a lot of communities, it has worked for them over the years. But as their residents get older and they're starting to have more medical calls, and they're also having trouble getting the volunteer staffing at the levels they need to respond to all those calls. And so then that puts pressure on them to either, you know, lean on their neighbors who may not be, you know, neighboring communities that may also have challenges, or, you know, it makes them think about, you know, increasing their pay or even shifting to full-time staff, and that which is much more expensive. So even though you're seeing the share of town budgets going to fire and EMS, going up a little bit over the last 30 years, you're still seeing, from what we hear, you know, greater challenges for towns to sort of respond to that critical service.
You mentioned debt earlier. Is that what some towns are having to do, borrow more money to close that gap?
You are seeing more of that. And under the state's levy limits for property taxes, there's actually an exemption for property taxes that you levy to make debt payments. So it kind of provides this incentive to communities in the state to actually use debt for things that they might have paid for in cash in the past. And we are seeing debt rise. So, you know, the debt kind of that's backed by towns' full taxing power, that rose by almost 45% between 2014 and 2020, and now stands at essentially record levels. You're also seeing debt payments rise as a share of town spending, and they're not quite at record levels, but pretty close. And so, you know, there is a concern that over time, it crowds out other spending that these local communities may need.
Are there long-term structural solutions that people are pointing toward?
Well, there's, I think, a lot of things that could be considered. I mean, one thing that we have looked at for both towns and other larger communities is partnering with other local governments to deliver services. And particularly in the case of fire and EMS services, that is certainly something that may help towns continue to provide service and to do so, you know, potentially more efficiently, either by providing better service or providing it at a lower cost. You know, other things that, towns, you know, may want to look at is ways to collaborate in other areas like road maintenance or road construction, looking at ways to, you know, potentially find new sources of revenue. You know, one idea that was floated by someone I talked to would be allowing, you know, any their property taxes to rise more quickly if the money was spent on local roads. So, I mean, you know, those are some of the challenges that, or some of the approaches that could be used to address some of these difficulties.
Jason, thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's Jason Stein, Research Director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, with us today sharing the nonprofit's latest report on budget challenges facing Wisconsin town governments. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Father's Day was just yesterday. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story from 2020 about the unique way he and his daughter have stayed in touch over the years.
When my daughter Erica was a little girl, she started a now 25-year tradition of sending me letters on pieces of birch bark. Last winter, we sat down and talked about how and why it began.
I remember having a book, and in the book, there were all these wacky ideas, experiments, and things that kids could do. And one of the things was you could put a stamp on a banana and send it in the mail. I saw that and I wondered if it actually worked. And so I thought, what can I put through the mail? And I knew that you could write on birch bark and you could draw on it. So I thought, why not try a letter?
You have the first letter there somewhere. Mm-hmm. Why don't you read it to me?
Well, they all start the same. And they say, "Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. I am having a great time here, but I miss you a lot. Love you, Erica."
I think you were 5 or 6.
Yeah, well, I spelled writing R-I-T-I-N-G.
So when did you decide to do it again?
I don't remember. I think it's, I mean, I know why I do it now. I can't remember why I did it when I was younger. Now it's whenever I'm out in the woods and we're hiking and I see a piece of birch bark on the ground, I pick it up because it's a great fire starter, but also because I can write to you from wherever I am, and it's a personal message.
Why don't you read the one you have right in front of you?
"Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. We are having a very fun time. I hope you the same, Erica." And then I have made a heart, a smiley face, and a swirly, which I believe was my signature at the time.
How old do you think you were then?
Probably 8.
And you are now 29,
mm-hmm.
So you've sent me a letter every year or so.
The spelling's gotten a little better. Handwriting is a little neater,
yeah.
Not much. You have to find the right piece of birch bark that can lie flat and can take the pen ink. Sometimes you have to scrape off a few layers of the birch bark, but that's neat because then you use that to start the fire and you write a letter on the rest of it.
And you sent some that actually have stamps on them.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you read that one?
"Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. Although this won't send until I get back to the cities, I wanted you to know that I was thinking of you and Mama out here in the wilderness. Will you and Finn come back here with me someday? It is magical here. I love you, and I hope all is well. Love, Bun."
Do you recall many of the places you've sent them from?
Boundary Waters. Yeah, up in northern Wisconsin, I've done a lot of canoeing up there. I sent you one from Alaska. That birch bark wasn't from there because they don't have birch trees up in the Brooks Range of Alaska. So I brought it with Minnesota.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to tell you is that these letters mean a whole lot to me. As you can see, I've collected them and kept them safe over the years. And I never know when one is going to come in, but I always am delighted to see it.
Well, I'm not going to stop the tradition anytime soon. There's two I want to read.
Okay.
"Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. I love this tradition we have, and I hope we never stop doing it. I hope your summer is in full swing and filled with biking, grilling, outdoor music, and paddling. I can't wait to do some or all of those things with you when I visit in July. I love you, Papa, and I think about you whenever I find new music to love. You gave me that gift. Love, Bun. Dear Papa, I'm writing to you on birch bark. We are about to embark on our journey north, and I wanted to write and say thank you for all the adventures you took me on and for inspiring me to go on my own. Thank you. Happy Papa's Day. Love, Bun.
Thank you very much for sending me all those letters over the years. I really appreciate it.
I'm going to keep sending them, so.
Erica is a wilderness EMT and firefighter in Montana. Because of the pandemic, we've not seen each other since January. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Coming up, we talked to one of the authors of a study on gun violence in Green Bay and what it can tell us about violence prevention. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. A new study looks at gun violence in Green Bay between 2019 and 2021. Green Bay doesn't have a lot of violence, with lower rates than many communities. That meant that researchers were able to include all incidents with shots fired in their study, rather than just homicides and gunshot injuries. David Muhammad is the executive director of the National Institute for Criminal Justice Reform, which conducted the study for Green Bay. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
What did you set out to figure out here as you started to study all of the shooting incidents in Green Bay over that span?
The intention was to do a deep dive assessment of all gun violence in the city of Green Bay and see if we can determine, is there a pattern, who is involved, what are the primary motives or causes, and how can we identify individuals at high risk prior to an incident to have effective intervention to reduce these types of incidents.
What did you find? What kind of patterns did you find?
I think first and foremost, similar to other cities, despite, as you mentioned, and the onset, Green Bay is dissimilar in that it has a pretty low rate of gun violence, which is wonderful. But the violence that does occur, the gun violence that does occur, is somewhat similar to several cities around the country, where it's very tightly concentrated. Gun violence is concentrating Green Bay to a small number of people, and somewhere between 60 and 70% of shootings, maybe even higher, people involved have very similar risk factors. They are young adults. I think that was a big surprise to many people, that the average age of somebody involved in gun violence in the city of Green Bay is in their late 20s. And if you look at homicide victims, we're talking about 27, 28 years old and suspects. The other is people who are very well known to the criminal justice system. So they have several previous arrests. Often they're under the supervision of probation and parole. And demographically, they're large. You know, it's disproportionately Black males. And the caution I've been giving about that statistic is, remember, it's a small number of people, right? So the vast majority of Black males in Green Bay are in no way engaged in gun violence. But we do know this small number of people who are well known to the criminal justice system. And the other key factor is many are connected to some sort of group or crew or clique, and some might call gang, but many aren't traditional gangs as we know them in this work, with, you know, signs and colors and all that stuff. Most of these are either neighborhood cliques or just these fly by the night groups, but they are groups, and they often may commit crimes together. And when you add all of those risk factors together, it's a really small number of people in Green Bay, you know, really no more than 100 people who have these risk factors, who are driving the vast majority of gun violence in the city.
When it comes to the lead up to a shooting incident, whether it's fatal or even leads to an injury, is there a common story, a common sequence of events that takes us into that shooting?
Yeah, there really is. And I'm not sure, I think this might be surprising to many listeners. A common story is really a conflict around a young woman. And so there's a guy in town who might be dating my ex-girlfriend. I don't want it to be my ex-girlfriend, and I'm upset that he's dating her. And I am now in conflict with him in social media, right? So I'm posting things to his Instagram account or whatever social media. And now we're in a back and forth social media conflict that then plays out in real time, in real life. Sometimes that playing out as we bumped into each other at a gas station or at a bar or a club, which is, that happens a lot more in Green Bay than other places. And now there's a shooting. And so you mix these kind of petty conflicts with the access to firearms and you have these shooting incidents. The other thing we found, as you mentioned, we were able to really assess more than just injury shootings and homicides. We were able to assess shots fired, and there were many, many more shots fired. And in fact, the portion of shots fired when no one was hit was larger than we've seen anywhere, and which leads us to believe that these were deliberate, meaning people were deliberately shooting people's cars and maybe even shooting their homes, not intending to hit someone, to send a message, to scare someone. We were able to collect information on those incidents that are harder to collect when it's harder to make an arrest. It's a question about a victim, but we were actually able to collect quite a bit of information, and those were similar to the incidents of homicides and shots fired. It is this small population that is pretty identifiable, and much of the violence is predictable, and therefore it is preventable.
Let's get in. I want to spend the rest of our time on that preventable part. Knowing what we know about that in Green Bay and maybe similar stories elsewhere, what do we do with that information?
Yeah, I think a couple of key pieces. One, the police department, which was extraordinarily helpful in this process and really for a small city, for a small department, had better information than we expected going into this study. But that being said, I think the department could do even more by focusing attention on gun violence specifically. And they're in the process of doing that, having a team that just focuses on gun violence and nothing else. Second, is develop more community services focused on this population. And this is a big one because there really isn't any programs. There's some great programs. I met with community-based organizations during the course of this study, and we sat down with several, even sat down with staff of the Packers. And there's some really great organizations doing great work, but there's not, and this is usual to many cities, there's not many, if any, specifically working with people at this very highest risk, the 25-year-old who has four or five previous arrests, who is not interested in services, but that is somebody we have to focus intervention on. And so part of the recommendations of the city is develop programs that provide mentoring, life coaching, case management, outreach services to these individuals. But the other thing, lastly, is a process by which we are getting ahead of these incidents. I mentioned that a lot of it plays out on social media. Part of focusing on gun violence in the police department is, are you monitoring social media? Are you looking at individuals who have these combination of risk factors and talking to them and advising them that they are at high risk, advising them that they have the potential to receive services, but that they are on the radar of law enforcement. When you do those combination of things, you really can get ahead of shootings and reduce those incidents.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's David Muhammad, Executive Director of the National Institute for Criminal Justice Reform. His organization conducted a study of all the gun violence in Green Bay from 2019 to 2021. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, if you want to boost your health, go with your gut. A gastroenterologist tells us why our digestive system is so important to our overall well-being and offers some food advice and recipes to help. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.